What's up, everybody? Welcome into another episode of the Lawyer You Know podcast. I'm really excited about the topic we've picked for this podcast because up until now, this is the most requested video that I've gotten that I didn't do a video on, if that makes sense, because I didn't cover this case. So I didn't know enough about it, but my guest today on the podcast covered it, the entire trial, knows everything that happened, is going to be able to give us a summary, is going to be able to ask the questions that all of you have, and we're going to get into a discussion about the Melody Ferris Byrne Pyle trial that ended with one of the wildest sentencing hearings I have ever seen. I've really never seen anything like it. We'll get into why. But I know so many of you guys had questions, and today I'm excited to have Scott from Recovery Addict on, who streams trials. He streamed this one. He has questions about it, and he was just as shocked as everyone else when this happened. Scott, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Peter, thank you very much for the opportunity. I'm still like trying to pick my jaw up from the floor from what we saw in the Melody Ferris trial. I mean, we had recently three high profile cases where the women defendant were sentenced. In all three cases, their significant other was the victim, whether it was the past, present, or future husband. I guess in each case it was a little bit different. Mm-hmm. But two of them were just off the charts wild. The Benefield case sentencing was pretty normal. Sarah Boone and Melody Ferris, just boom, you know, mind blown on both of them. Excited to talk about Melody Ferris today.
Yeah. And I think so that people know what we're talking about, especially I know anybody coming from Recovery Addict probably knows a lot about this case, but some people I think that haven't watched the entire trial or just came across it, because really it blew up on my Twitter timeline after the sentencing. It was basically the same time as Benefield and Boone, just like you said, two sentencings that we did cover because we covered those trials. But for anybody that doesn't know what this case is about and, you know, the background or the summary of the case, can you give us kind of a high level of what the accusations were, what the defense's arguments were, and how the trial kind of went through?
Sure. As with any case, there are a lot of players, and I'll try to just hit the highlights. There are a lot more people involved in this, but Melody Ferris is the defendant. She's a mature lady. She has four adult children, two sons and two daughters, and she was charged with murdering her husband, Gary, and putting his body on the burn pile on the property and basically burning up the remains until there was only about 30 pounds of his 300 and something pounds left. Pretty crazy case. This particular case tore the family apart. They were divided. It was sort of like a 3-1 split as far as the children go about who thought who did what. And instead of them thinking there was an outside player involved, the mom blamed the son, Scott, who lived on the property, and Scott blamed the mom, who was obviously on the property. As you get into this and you start looking into a little bit about, you know, Chris and Scott, the two sons, and you've also got Amanda and Emily, the two daughters. This was like peering into somebody's closet and seeing all the dark skeletons. This family had issues. And on the outside, they were wealthy. Gary was a very prominent lawyer in the Atlanta area. I think he did like bankruptcies or business law, but he was very successful, mm-hmm. brought in a lot of money, but they spent it like crazy. And all the kids in one way or another were sort of dependent on their dad's money, even though they had sort of moved on in life and moved out. And so the prosecution starts by basically doing a lot what we saw in the Karen Reed trial, where they're trying to prove why it wasn't somebody else. Why it wasn't, you know, and they spend a lot of time trying to focus on why it wasn't Scott that committed the murder. And he was cleared, even though at the very beginning he was listed as a suspect. The police were thinking, you know, this could be the guy, but they cleared him and he had a solid alibi. But then the police looked at Melody, and Melody's alibi was, I didn't hear anything. I didn't do it. And that was it. And she was on the property all day, she said. And this happened, I think it was on the third or fourth of July in 2018. He was found on the 5th of July by Scott as they were looking on the property for him. And initially they thought there was some sort of a medical incident where he had fallen into the fire and, you know, it was tragic. And then as investigation went on, they found the slug from a 38 bullet in his ribs, one of the ribs that hadn't burned up. And suddenly that changed everything. And then it just exploded and went, and it just went off the rails from there. It was crazy. So more backstory. Gary had a extramarital affair with an office coworker. Melody had, I think, two extramarital affairs and was still having one at the time. And so there's motive all over the place. The sons want the money. The Melody is being sort of restricted from money decisions in the household and wants more access there. And there's a fair amount of money tied up in the farm, you know, arguably millions of dollars, you know, at stake here. And so everyone sort of got scrutinized on this one. But
so it sounds like a lot of the trial and a lot of the background had to do with this dysfunctional family that, you know, if we're looking at it from the outside, wealthy lawyer, married for a long time to his wife, four adult children, some of them married with kids, you know, grandkids, I think I know was a part of the trial as well, or at least a part of the sentencing. And from the outside looking in, everything looked great. And then when you start to peel back the layers, it gets uglier and uglier and uglier, which sometimes can provide a really clear motive for one person. Sometimes it can muddy the waters and make it kind of difficult for a jury to figure out who did what. But from what I understand about the trial, it wasn't really clear exactly how he got to the burn pile, right? Exactly how he passed, you know, what was used, what actually took his life. How did the prosecution put that together and actually prove who did what, when, and how he ended up on the burn pile?
Well, they basically said, there are some things we don't know the answer to and we'll never know. But, you know, you can do the math and the circumstantial evidence builds up. And there are some big issues. There are some big issues that out there that Melody had a hard time overcoming in her defense. One of them was that her boyfriend at the time this occurred had made a statement to police because he was investigated early on as well. And in that statement, he said that Melody called him at 2 o'clock in the morning and said, Gary's on the burn pile. Basically more than 24 hours before his body was found. And that statement stood out there for 11 months until he recanted it in a future thing. But that was huge. And there was all sorts of issues about, you know, do we trust him or not? Because they had a little secret code they were using and code words on their jail calls back and forth. Basically, you know, we don't know. Was it the tractor? Was it the side-by-side? How did a very, you know, a small stature woman carry a very good-sized man out and get him on top of the burn pile with no evidence?
They didn't find the drag marks, right? Anything like that, where she just, you know, grabbed him by the feet and dragged him. It was kind of a downhill area, right? So I heard some people's actually, I one of the things I did listen to was an interview with a juror, and I believe the juror said, oh, I could have done it if I would have pushed him down the hill or something like that. But he was like 300 plus pounds from what I've read. And she's not a large or relatively strong looking individual, being Melody Ferris. So it really would make me think there's got to be an accomplice, if it was her, that at least helped her move the body. And I guess that statement of the boyfriend was one of the big things that connected her to having knowledge of what happened.
Yeah, there was a tractor on the property, like a Kubota tractor with a little front end loader. There was some DNA evidence found on there, but it was in the wrong spot. Like Gary's DNA was found in like the passenger compartment where you drive, and not in the bucket where you'd expect the body to be. And the bucket didn't look like it had really been disturbed. So there are a lot of questions that, you know, to this day, I'm like, I don't know how you put that together. But I mean, there was also a bullet with Gary's DNA found on it, a 38 caliber bullet in the basement of Melody's house. And how do you get a bullet there? There was no holes anywhere. There was no pools of blood. There was no, you know, disturbed furniture. And her house looked like a Southern Living show home. It was just immaculate, you know, decorated to the nines. And here's this bloody bullet found down by his chair in the basement where he sort of worked. And there's no explanation of how they got there. The police actually spent a lot of time initially in the investigation. They brought in one of those karate, like boxing dummies, you know, like the torso with the head, and they put a bulletproof jacket on him and they shot him in the house, like over and over and over, using sound measuring devices so they could see how loud the sounds were in different places, just to see, does Melody's story of I didn't hear anything check out? Is that so possible?
They did prove that she was home when the shots were fired.
Well, her own statement was that she was home.
Okay.
So that's what they went with. They did find, she said she hadn't left the house. They did find that she actually did leave the house that day. She went to a Walmart and bought a whole bunch of different cleaning supplies, which never looks good. We joke about it being on the murder aisle at Walmart. It always seems to be a Walmart involved, but a bunch of different cleaning supplies. She says it was just regular stuff. But there's one police officer said he smelled bleach when he came into the home. Nobody else did. But just a lot of question marks, and I wish there was a more satisfactory outcome that we could put the pieces together and see the whole puzzle, but it didn't end that way.
Yeah, it sounds really sketchy to me. I mean, it sounds like, and so from what I heard also about the, I've listened to some like summary videos. I didn't watch the trial, but just to get background about, you know, who she is, what the setup is, but they were living on different floors. They've been estranged for, you know, like 20 years. Most of their marriage, they've been estranged. Maybe they had some kind of agreement, whatever it may be. I've heard people pontificate about, you know, in Georgia, if you cheat, you can be at fault for the divorce and get less money. So that's what she was worried about. But I mean, not a young lady, 20 years of already having this estranged marriage. Like, was there something at this point that they had, a letter, a text, an email, that there was some breaking point where she was like, this is it, it's over for us, I got to take Gary out? Or how did they, why did they prove now was the time she decided to act?
Oh man, there were a lot of text messages admitted. A lot of them actually had to do with Scott.
Okay.
There was a lot of stress between Melody and the children getting money from Gary. So Scott, according to Melody, was stealing dad's credit card. He didn't have a job. He lived on the property. All his expenses were basically Gary's money. Melody says he was stealing the credit card. Scott says it was all approved and it was all, you know, ran it by him. He'd always give me the card and go out and buy whatever he needed for the horses or for the, you know, the barn, whatever. So there's a lot of stress. Money was the underlying thing under all of this. Every relationship, the money issue was huge. But at the same time, even though Melody was, her names were taken off some of the accounts she didn't have access to, everybody testified that she got everything she wanted. If she wanted it, it was available. She'd get it.
Hurts motive.
Yeah. So, there was, the net gets a little convoluted at one point. And, I have to say, I background for me, I graduated with a communications degree. I like news. I work in the media, and the story they tell us is never be the story. And unfortunately in this case, we became the story and my face got entered as an exhibit in this trial, which I was not expecting at all. But Melody, at the time, her boyfriend was Rusty Barton. Rusty Barton's stepmom was Martha Jane. Martha Jane is an amazing old woman. I call her an old woman. She's elderly. She's like, everyone wants her as a grandma. She's worked at the bank for a bajillion years, knows everybody in town, and just the sweetest lady. Her health was failing. Her husband had passed away. And so Melody, who was basically, they were second cousins, but it was more like a daughter mother relationship, Melody would take care of her, would take her to the doctor, do what she needed to, you know, clean, help, you know, her house, decorate, do things like that. And Martha Jane confided in Melody about where some things were in the house. And one of them was a .38 special revolver her husband had bought her years ago. And Melody was the only person who knew. Martha Jane hadn't told anyone else. Well, during the questioning, during the trial, Rusty's on the stand, you know, Melody's stepson, and he's being questioned about what firearms he owns and everything else. And he's, you know, he was not a suspect, but he has lots of guns and everything. And the prosecutor asks about what guns his dad owned. And he says at the end, he's like, oh, and Martha Jane had a revolver too. I'm not sure about that. And at that point, do my little commentary, I've got my little headphones on in the corner. I'm talking. I say, I think I see where the state's going. I think they're going to say that Melody stole the gun from Martha Jane. And I was wrong, 100% wrong. The state did not go there. They didn't make that allegation whatsoever. But what I didn't know was that Martha Jane, who was a potential witness but had not been instructed not to watch the trial, was watching court that day, and she was watching on my channel. And so she hears me call out by her name. I call her out by name saying it's Martha Jane's gun that Melody might have taken. And her conscience gets pricked because she knows that her gun went missing. And she never told anyone. And even though the police came and questioned her, she says, they never asked me about the gun, so I didn't tell them. And she ends up calling the investigator and saying, hey, I was watching mid-trial court mid-trial, and I've got something to tell you. My gun went missing, and it was only Melody who knew where it was.
Oh, wow.
And she ended up testifying. And the defense attorney obviously was not very happy with the late revelation.
I'm sure.
I think I'm exhibit 14 something, I probably forget.
that's
wild case.
I mean, that's today's day and age, which I'm sure we'll talk about eventually. But so it seems like some issues with the state getting to beyond a reasonable doubt, but also seems like Scott and Melody were the main two suspects that everybody was focusing on. Did they straight up, because, you know, I think you followed the Lori Vallow case as well.
A little bit.
And so she didn't really want to come out and point the finger at Chad Daybell. Chad Daybell's team kind of a little bit more pointed the finger at her. Did Melody's team point the finger at Scott straight up, or was it more
from the get go? It was, he's the guilty party, and he's trying to frame us. And it was just back and forth, and the family was divided over it. And, you know, they're how they view the same situation, you know, from different vantage points. It tore them apart. But Melody, and I believe it was Amanda, one of the daughters, Amanda said, you know, somebody has to stick with mom and it's going to be me. So I'll support her.
Okay.
But at the same time, she sort of said, you know, I'm going to let the process play out and, you know, let the law run its course.
So they're basically pointing the finger at Scott. But even if nobody proved it was Scott, there's a lot of reasonable doubt, at least so it seems, or holes in the story, potentially holes in the evidence, lacking evidence, maybe some contradicting evidence. You know, who's cheating on who actually does that give somebody motive? So it gets to the jury eventually, and explain what that process was like while you're waiting for the verdict.
Oh man. It took much longer than I thought it would. I did believe that, you know, after listening to the evidence that it couldn't have been anybody but Melody. I still couldn't fill in the gaps, and I wish I could. I wish I could say, you know, I've got this figured out in my brain and beyond reasonable doubt, this is what happened. But the jury just deliberated and deliberated and deliberated and came back. It was about 16 days of testimony. So it was a fairly lengthy trial, and came back with a guilty verdict. And that's when, I mean, we thought the fireworks would be over then, but that just exploded from there with the statement that Melody made in closing. Just
did they ever report that they couldn't come to a verdict?
I believe I'm trying to remember. I've watched a few too many cases. My brain's jumbled.
I think they did. For some reason I have in my head that they had to be given an Allen charge and then came back with the guilty verdict, but I'm not positive. I think that's what the juror said. I'm not positive, but it was a struggle. It was a struggle to get to the
formal Allen charge, but they were close to being deadlocked, and they deliberated further and reached the verdict.
Okay. So that makes sense. And so, but it wasn't a slam dunk. It wasn't 2 hours. It wasn't in and out quick. So that obviously, from an outsider's perspective or the public's perspective, when jurors struggle to get to a guilty verdict, there are some people that say it should be, you know, guaranteed. It should be quicker. There are some people say that longer is better because that means you're really considering everything. But regardless, we get to the guilty verdict, and now it comes time for sentencing. It's pretty much locked. She's going to get life in prison. But during the sentencing hearing, why don't you kind of set the scene as to what everybody else said before Melody Ferris said her statement, which she did not testify at trial.
Right.
But this was her moment to tell her story.
Right. Melody, let me back up. Melody had taken advice from counsel early on in the investigation, basically closed up their mouth and told everyone else to be quiet too, at advice of counsel. And throughout the entire trial, she was basically mute, you know, just answering the bare minimum questions that she asked you from the judge. Everyone else making the statements, you know, it was typical pre-sentencing victim impact statements until Melody got up and then she doubled down on everything her lawyers had said. First of all, she said she disagreed with her lawyers. You know, she realizes she almost like she regretted taking their advice on not testifying, on not talking, because here we are at the end of her case. She's now being sentenced. She's been found guilty. And what she wanted to say, what she felt had to come out, hadn't come out. And so she took that opportunity to start to, it was so sensational. She's like, you know, I've got to say this because not only am I innocent, I know who did it. And it's Scott. And then she went on and she started listing things, some things that didn't come out in trial, some things that did. But she listed, and Scott was sitting in the courtroom.
That's the wildest thing to me. It's like literally pointing the finger at your own son sitting in the courtroom. We're going to play a little clip of it in the podcast so people can kind of hear exactly what she does to point the finger at Scott. But she did not hold back. She's like, you were there. You were mad. You were down at the burn pile. I didn't tell anybody. I've covered for you for stealing and doing all this stuff in the past, but I can't cover for you for this. I had people telling me, you're a mother, you've got to cover for your son, and I just can't cover for my son anymore. I know it was you. I want the grandkids to know it was you. I want the family to know it was you. I want the world to know it was you. The truth rarely comes out in court, and that's exactly what happened in this case. I mean, she went off on her son saying he took the life of her husband and his father. I had never seen anything like that in a sentencing before.
Not only did I not do this, I know who did. I know Scott killed his father. He took my husband, the father of Chris, Emily, and Amanda. He took Big Daddy from our grandchildren, Ella, Addison, Olivia, Jax, and James, three of them who never got to know Gary. Scott, this is unforgivable. Scott, I have spent an entire life of loving and protecting you, but this, I refuse to cover for you. My mother, your mom, begged me to take the blame for this. She said after she talked to you, after Gary died, that she knew you had done it. Her exact words were, you are his mother. You have to take blame for this. And I told her no, that I couldn't. I still have three other children, grandchildren. And this is not a stolen credit card, a check, or a diamond ring that you've pawned, all of which you have done.
The state waited a long time to object, but they did. They objected. I think they objected twice during that. Both times the judge said, basically, I'll allow it, or what I normally do in this case is I'll let you question her. You know, she didn't take the stand. She's clearly introducing stuff that wasn't part of the trial. I'll just let you question her afterwards, and that will be good enough. And
I don't even understand. I heard the judge say that. I don't even understand what the state questioning her would do, number one. Number two, that's not what you're doing as a criminal defendant. You're not subjecting yourself to cross-examination by making a statement at sentencing. So I don't know how he could force her to be cross-examined. If I was her lawyer, I would object to that. What he can do, what's within his discretion, is to say, you can't talk about that. That has nothing to do with the sentence. We're not relitigating the case. We're not relitigating the facts. Your opportunity to say that in front of the jury has come and gone. What you can say to me is why I should have mercy on you, why, you know, what mitigating factors you have, if you're struggling with something, apologizing, taking, feeling sorry for, or taking responsibility for your actions and what you did. Those are all things that can affect your sentence. Those are all things you can talk about in the sentencing process. But, you know, giving me all the evidence that it was a third party that did this, that's for the trial, not for sentencing. And you can cut her off. That's well within his discretion. Very weird other remedies that he proposed. Like you said, yeah, I heard that too. Like, you can cross-examine her. No, you can't. Like, that would be very weird to let her be cross-examined by the prosecutors and ask whatever questions that could be used against her in a future trial. Is just not usually how it works. Now, in fairness to the prosecution, sentencing is also not usually where the defendant just gets to go unfettered and just point the finger at somebody else and give all of this evidence that didn't come in at trial for probably a million different reasons. The most of which being she would have had to testify to it and she chose not to. But this was an absolutely wild sentencing. And you look and the camera kept panning to family members, not just to Scott, but to his brother, to his sister. I think it was to, you know, some of their wives or husbands or whatever that may have been, family members in the gallery that all had shock and awe on their face and looked disgusted as she told her truth.
At one point, Chris and Scott were not sitting together. So Scott was sort of center courtroom and Chris was off to Scott's right. And so as this goes on, Chris, even early on, he looks at this and the camera's on him and he's doing this. He's doing the cut her off sign. You know, this is, he's like, can you believe what's happening here? And it continues. He's looking over at Scott. And then as the allegations came out, because there was stuff that was coming out that I think nobody had heard about, like that probably wasn't talked about publicly. I don't know if there was like, what about that? I'm not sure if it was all just like, I can't believe mom is saying this, or really? Did that happen? I'm not sure what the thoughts were there, but Thanksgiving dinner for this family is ruined forever. There's relationships are severed. This is torn apart. in a big way. But she doubled down throughout the entire thing, and the judge allowed the entire, I mean, even Sarah Boone's, you know, she had edited her statements. This was, we got the full spiel, and she's adamant. She's adamant that it was not her, that she didn't do it, and that she's taking the blame for Scott, and the murderer is still among us.
A mother, or at least not this mother, does not blame her child unless she knows he did it. Not thinks, knows. And I would never sit here and let the attorneys lay blame to him if I didn't know. You have no idea how heart-wrenching, gut-wrenching this is. John Luke says that I'm the most stoic person he's ever met. My response was, you never know how strong you are until that's your only choice. So before it said that the only reason I'm telling you this is because I got a guilty verdict. It's not. If it had come back as not guilty, I would have still been begging for justice, for help getting the right person convicted. As soon as I walked out of the courtroom, I promise you, I would have done that. Chris, Emily, Amanda, Ella, Addison, Olivia, Jack, and James, I am doing this for you. Carrie is gone, and trust me, when I say that he is in a better place, because this has been the worst nightmare. It's been hell on earth. Knowing that your own son did this, and it's only been by the grace of God that I have survived this last 6 years and 5 months. If I could, I would gladly trade places with Gary. Judge Kenna, I am begging you for help. Please do this for Gary and my family. I have missed years with the people that I love dearly. Help me restore my family. Be the person in Cherokee County that it is their task. I do not want years. I do not want to wait years for justice, years that I may not have. I know this is something that you may never have seen before. And I plead with you to throw this verdict out. Help me get justice for the correct person. As bad as it sounds, I want to be there to watch him chained and shackled and brought to justice. I plead with you. This is something that I will never recover from. I don't know that my family will ever recover from. Please help me. I'm begging you to restore my faith in the judicial system. I'm begging you, not for me, but for Gary and my children and my grandchildren.
Yeah, and from like in a real not just shock and awe, but real life perspective, when you're a family member or, you know, a victim's advocate or dealing with the family afterwards, and there's obvious holes in the evidence, this is not something that feels great to hear, right? That the uncle or brother or, you know, friend that is sitting right here next to you, and that's at Thanksgiving, that there seems to be just as much or, you know, at least some evidence against him, or that he was there or should have known or had the opportunity to do it, maybe had motive to do it, which are two of the things that sunk Melody. Like, just knowing that and hearing that again being laid out is an uncomfortable feeling that family members aren't going to like, friends aren't going to like. It's bad for him. The public now sees it. I assume, again, I didn't cover this trial, so I didn't have the benefit of talking to the chat like you did, talking to your chat. I assume there is at least a small percentage of people that think it could have been Scott, or he might have been involved in some sort.
it was a big split. And like, you know, we try to make sure in chat that people who are not guilty, who aren't suspects, aren't, you know, dragged through the mud in chat. Right. We're like, hey, that's, you know, the police have cleared them. That's not well, Melody pipes up and everyone's like, that's what I thought all along about Scott. And there were so many people who said, yeah, they're suspicious. And they have reason. I mean, they did find 38 caliber ammunition in his apartment. His bathroom had been clean, spick and span, and he's not a clean sort of person. They, you know, he was the one who said, hey, there was a gun downstairs that shouldn't have been there. Where's the gun's missing? All these things come up. There's some things that, you know, justify why the police said, you know, we've got to take a look at Scott. But equally there were things about Melody that just like, you know, you've got all the motive and she had some text, you know, that she was like, this is it, you know, I've had enough type texts, and things that she had shared with her, you know, Rusty in text that way. But, there were questions all around. And I mean, who drove the tractor? Melody knew how to drive the tractor. She could have used that to pull his body, but the whole bullet in the basement and no blood pools. How do you get that? I mean, this is like a fancy rugs and furniture and, you know, do you clean up? No one's that good at cleaning up a crime.
How'd you get him out of the basement with the tractor?
Yeah. There's this huge question. Did you lure him outside and shoot him? But then how did the bullet end up in the house? And it's, you know, I wish, you know, I had a crystal ball or could go back in time and see it, because there's huge holes.
Feels like one of those cases that sucks because it's a tragedy. It seems like it was a family member, really the only people that would have wanted to do this or could have done it at this location with all of these tools around. But like, from my perspective, it's hard to prove a case like that as a prosecutor too. It's really hard to prove a case like that. You go forward. Like I say, most of the time it's a guilty verdict. It's not really a surprise when it's a guilty verdict. It's more of a surprise when it's a not guilty verdict. But this is one that seems like, you know, and even listening to the interview of the juror, like holes had to be filled with inferences, maybe even imagination or, you know, taking context from here and applying it to there. And it's just one of those situations that feels a little uncomfortable to even get to the guilty verdict on anyone, let alone when there are two potential people pointing the finger at each other, which is exactly how Melody Ferris went down. I'm sure there are going to be appellate issues. I'm sure she's going to have arguments that happened in the trial that are going to be worth appealing. But this jury found this evidence to be enough to convict this defendant, regardless of what she said about her son, regardless about what other arguments she may have had at trial. And, you know, those are verdicts that we have to respect, even though sometimes they can be very difficult to understand, especially as you see back there. And I think the time the jury took to make the verdict is also indicative of a difficult decision in a case and some arguments on both sides being available. As you watched the trial, what were some of the things that came up in your head? Some of the questions you had, things you couldn't get over, just from a lawyer's perspective that maybe I could answer.
Well, towards the end, obviously, I had some questions about, you know, what happens when a client disagrees with the advice of counsel. You know, so there are some decisions just the client can make and some the lawyer gets to make. I don't question my doctor about treatment for, you know, an illness I'm getting, you know, he's the expert.
Well, some people do these days, right? With DocMD or whatever it's called, or WebMD. But yeah, I think that it's really important to build a good attorney-client relationship. I believe she had private attorneys, if what I read was correct. So she chose her attorneys. She chose to stick with them. And this is the purpose. A lot of people don't understand, why do we do this in open court where the judge sits down, talks to the defendant before they don't testify, asks them all these questions under oath, asks them if they're under the influence of anything, if they understand what their highest level of education is. Why do we ask all those questions if they're just going to say, I'm not going to testify because my lawyer told me to? Well, the reason is to document the record that, legally speaking, for appellate purposes, if she didn't agree with her lawyers, if she wanted to overrule them, she could have. She could, A, fire her lawyers. Some judges wouldn't necessarily allow that in the middle of trial or wouldn't like that or wouldn't give a continuance. She could say, no, judge, in open court, I do want to testify. I disagree with my lawyers. Where in that case, it could create a conflict. It could create a situation where the judge says, this is a client's decision. It's their decision. And I don't know very many criminal defense lawyers that would try to silence or overcome their client's decision not to waive and to testify, right? They might strongly suggest certain things. They might say, you know, it's not going to be good for you. I have found the best advice, if we really think it would be a bad idea for a client to testify, to say, you can testify. It is your decision. We just think, after hearing your testimony, okay, because we prep them, so we know what their testimony would be. We know the best version. We know the worst version. You know, at trial, usually somewhere in the middle comes out. But after hearing your testimony and seeing all the other evidence in the case, we think there is a higher probability of you getting convicted if you do testify than if you don't. As lawyers who have done this for a long time, you pay us, you choose us, you've trusted us. This is our advice. Now, if you want to testify, that's fine. We just think the probability goes up for you being convicted of murder and being sentenced to prison the rest of your life. It's very hard for a client to then disagree with a lawyer at that point in the litigation and say, forget it, I'm going to testify anyways. Some clients do. Some clients do.
Would you make that decision based on the facts that might come out, or the fact that you're not experienced? You're going up against an experienced lawyer who's going to question you in very artful ways that might lead you down into a trap where something comes out you don't intend. I mean, what do you weigh all of that together, or is it just...
There are two or three main factors. The number one factor, I would say, which might surprise some people, from my perspective, the number two factor is probably what most people think is most important. The most important factor to me is, what evidence does the state have against you to prove this case? Regardless of how good of a witness you are, regardless of how believable you are, regardless of how great your story or how many facts or context you can add to it, which is the second factor, is how good of a witness, how believable of a witness, how helpful is the facts or are the facts and evidence that they're going to bring out, right? Because sometimes they want to talk about all this stuff that doesn't even really help the case. So that's factor number two. But really the most important thing is, do they have enough, from my perspective, to prove that you did this beyond a reasonable doubt? And if they don't, why take the risk? Why put you up on the stand where, if the jury just doesn't like you, if they think you're lying about something that doesn't matter and they start thinking to themselves, why lie? Guilty people lie. And you know that can just start to snowball into, now you're guilty when the state didn't really have enough evidence against you. My guess would be, after hearing what I've heard about this case, listening to some of the summaries, listening to you explain it, that's probably where her lawyers were coming from. Like, they can't prove there was no murder weapon, right? They never found it. They can't put it in her hand. They can't really prove how they can give, you know, speculate and give all these different options of how she moved him down to the burn pile. That's a big hole. Now, what if she testifies? It's like, yeah, I'm great with the tractor. Have you ever moved an animal with the tractor? Yes, I have. And they get more context about, she's moved animals. Of course she could move a human body, whatever it may be. So there are some holes in their case. And then they have a third party culprit to point to in Scott, who is more capable of moving the body, who could have done the deed somewhere else and then brought his dad. And that's why there's no blood in the basement or whatever it may be, maybe in the bathroom where he carried him out, whatever it may be. So they felt like, from their perspective, there wasn't enough evidence to convict Melody Ferris specifically of this crime, and to put her on the stand is only going to hurt her case. It's not going to help it. And if, like you're saying, most of what she did in her sentencing, just those wild statements, was repeat a lot of what her lawyer said, if they were able to get out a lot of that evidence and point the finger at Scott without her having to testify, that's also a risk and benefit you've got to take in. How much of this important probative evidence can we get out without you taking the stand? And if that percentage is high enough, again, that weighs into our advice is you don't take the stand. So we weigh all of that. It's not just, are you credible? It's not just, will you be good? We weigh all of that together when giving our advice to clients as to whether or not you should testify in your own defense, because more times than not, it goes poorly for the defendant. That's just a fact. Because of what you said, it's a skilled, litigator that's cross-examining you that's going to be able to use what you say to benefit their version of the events. And sometimes what we do with clients as well is, you know, we have multiple lawyers in our firm. We'll, you know, catch them up to speed somewhat. We'll do a direct examination and have them cross-examine her. And sometimes when they see how poorly that goes, like in civil cases, sometimes that helps us settle cases. Sometimes right. It brings out like, hey, don't overreach. Don't exaggerate, right? Like, just tell the truth. When you exaggerate, you give them an opportunity to blow a hole through your story. So don't exaggerate. Just tell the truth and stick to the story. And sometimes it can be really helpful with that. But using kind of a mock cross-examination can help clients understand the issues in their testimony, because most people think, I'm the best person to tell my story. I want to tell it. I'm going to tell the truth, and nothing can go wrong if I can just get on there on the stand and tell my story. And that's very rarely the case.
Yeah, very rarely does the jury think exactly the way the defendant does. But in this particular case, speaking of the jury, I think the prosecution knew that there were some stretches that they needed the jury to leap over. There was a jury view on here. the jury went out to the property and you know, walked out there, saw the burn pit, saw the house, saw the location, the barn, you know, where everything was. I think it was important for the prosecution to, and obviously we didn't get to go. The farm was lost. The family lost the farm shortly after Gary's death because the money was tied up and nobody really had access to it. So it got sold off, auctioned off, and it was under other ownership, but the police negotiated. They got the, well, I'm not sure if they negotiated. They said, we need to be out there.
So yeah, they brought the jury out. Basically forced order it in most jurisdictions.
Yeah. And I got to think that's had to be helpful because so many of us who didn't know the property are trying to map it out in our heads based on the limited body cam footage, you know, of how things went down. And, you know, there's so many questions and so many pieces that it, I don't think there was ever any evidence that was submitted that made anyone really think, at least in our community, in our chat, that there was a third person involved, a third, you know, culprit other than Scott and Melody. It seemed like those were the only two options. But, you know, there's so many, you know, Scott deleted the game camera footage. Turns out there was nothing really on it. They were able to recover that. There was a camera down there, but he had, you know, why did you delete that? You know, is that everything just raised suspicion levels back and forth. And this is one of those trials. I want to like cool off for a minute and then go back and watch it from the beginning. Know what I know now and just try to pick out little bits and see if there's something else that can fill in some of those gaps because you're left. Yeah, there's a verdict. You know, somebody's going to prison for the rest of her life over this, but it doesn't feel complete.
Yeah, I definitely think the jury view helped based on, you know, watching the juror interview that I saw, because that's really, she put a lot of stock in it being downhill versus like if you had to carry the body up the mountain, then really it could only be the tractor or, you know, having the help of somebody else. But also, you may have mentioned it or maybe it was on another summary. Now I'm kind of, they're all mixing together. Maybe it was that juror, but if Melody even said she was at the house and they get to go see the house, although I heard it was like an 8,000 square foot house, they're like, yeah, there's no way, you know, even though you said they have a sound person and they're, you know, they're doing this testing, jurors trust their own eyes and ears over anything else that is told to them. I've had cases where, you know, we'll talk about a herniated disc in the neck and we'll have board certified radiologists come and explain what a herniation is and what it looks like. And here it is on the MRI, and doggone it. Every time the jury's like, we want to see the MRI picture ourselves. We want to look at it and we want to see if we can see something abnormal about that disc with no training or, you know, any more understanding than what they have for the trial. So I can almost guarantee the jury goes out there. Yeah. The jury goes out there and they're like, this house is big, but I think I'd be able to hear a gunshot if I was, you know, on the second floor, the third floor, whatever floor it might be, and somebody's firing a gun in the basement of this house or the barn or whatever where Scott lived. I'm sure there was a lot of that in the jury view as well, which is a strategic decision for the lawyers to make as to whether or not you're going to do that.
Going back to that decision not to talk, what happens now from a lawyer's perspective with her making that statement? Can that in any way affect or hamper her appeal or hurt her in some way?
Not really. I mean, if I don't think it's a successful appellate argument, but if they really wanted to use something like ineffective assistance of counsel, that could be part of the ineffective assistance of counsel claim where she had pertinent evidence nobody else could testify to that would have proven Scott committed the crime. And because her lawyers made the wrong decision or advice where, you know, overruling her wanting to testify, that's part of an overall ineffective assistance of counsel claim. That could be something her appellate lawyers do. Again, she'll probably have different lawyers appeal the case. That's the norm, especially if they're going to point the fingers at the lawyers that tried the case prior. But again, the colloquy with the judge where she answers those questions under oath, it's very, very difficult. And you know, the way appellate case law and precedent works is we can't let clients just go back and have a second shot at it and say, oh, okay, you chose not to testify this time, realizing the what you're waiving and the right to testify in your own defense. You have a right to do that. You're waiving that right. It's explained in detail to them. You know that if you do that, you don't get a second bite at the apple. You don't get to see how the trial goes the right way or both ways. So that's not going to be just a general winning appellate argument. Now, again, like I said, if it's part of an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, maybe. I don't really see any of that hurting her appeal. Right? It's not like she made any admissions. It's not like she did anything that was in contradiction to what her defense already was based on what you're telling me. So I don't see anything just based off her statement and what I know about the case that she did anything that's going to be majorly problematic on appeal.
Interstate, but she did bring up something that we hadn't heard in trial, and that's she talks about antifreeze under the kitchen sink, which seems to go to a poisoning type scenario, which never came out at trial. But we did hear that Gary had, you know, these spells where he'd get really sick. And she brought that up. And then towards the end, she said, basically she put out an open invitation because you can't appeal based on the jury got it wrong.
Right.
That doesn't work. It has to be some sort of error that was made by the judge or, you know, something along those lines.
Well, the jury getting it wrong, theoretically, if no reasonable juror could ever come with that verdict, there could be some post trial remedies, but it's very, very unusual.
Yeah.
What you're saying is there had to be problems in the trial. Right.
Right. But I think she knows that. And so she basically threw it out there in her statement and said, "Hey, I will work with anyone to try to bring this to light." She's basically, you know, calling all private investigators, you know, let's dig this further. You know, I'm available. I'll make myself available and we'll continue. I'll keep pushing until this comes to light. And, you know, as someone who felt that she was guilty, I'm like, wow, she really feels strongly about her innocence. And it made me question, you know, did I get it right?
I got to be honest, like listening to her at sentencing, she's either a sadistic psychopath or she's innocent. Like to be able to sit there knowing what you did to your husband, right? If she did it, knowing what you did to your family and then knowing what you did to your son, right? Taking his dad. And then what do? You heap hot coals on top of him by pointing the finger directly at him, blaming him for this, ruining his life probably, right? Because I mean, everybody that knows him probably knows this is going on. And now they see this, it's like, unless they all just believe his mom is, you know, literally a criminal psychopath, this is tough because there's a lot of now questions and looking at him a little side eye and could he have done it? Did he do it? Didn't seem to be enough evidence against his mom. And she seems very confident it was him, whatever it may be. Like she was resolute and not just her innocence, but Scott's guilt.
Yeah. I've never seen that passionate of a statement from obviously a convicted, you know, defendant. And it shook me a little bit. I've got to admit, it shook me. I'm like, wow.
Yeah.
Did I just basically hold grandma guilty for someone else's crime?
Yeah, but the other thing about that is a lot of times those statements don't come out only because judges won't let them. There's probably a ton of defendants that want to point the finger at somebody else for committing the crime that they knowingly committed. So that is one of the reasons it's more unusual is because most judges would cut defendants off if they go down that story and start going for things that are just way outside the facts of the case, right? And we saw it in the Benefield sentencing where the judge kept cutting off even, you know, the victim impact statements where they started to go at the defendant or say things that were not about, you know, the character, the uniqueness about the victim and how he'll be missed and what a great person he is and things like that versus how deplorable and horrible it is that the defendant did X, Y, or Z or that she lied about this or lied about that was not appropriate for sentencing and the judge was cutting people off. So every sentencing is a little different because there's a lot of judicial discretion, but this was definitely an unusual one.
The judge, I really like the judge. He's sort of like a down to earth, just says what on his mind. Not really polished as far as that goes, but just a really likable fellow. And he did make some comments during the trial, especially he's sort of up to date technology wise. And he saw early on that there was a great deal of interest, obviously, you know, with, you know, some of the big networks that were coming in covering this case. And it was sort of like a first for the courtroom. And obviously it was a first for the defense attorneys. In their interview after, I think they were talking to, I think it was Court TV. They basically said, "I never want to try another televised trial again."
Isn't that interesting?
And I wanted to sort of pick your mind a little bit on that as, you know, I'm a huge fan of transparency in court. I think it goes a long way to have people trust the system and understand the system. What are your thoughts on what, you know, sort of what this new, you know, social media and the, you know, TV in the courtrooms, what it's become and where it's going. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. I mean, I have so many thoughts on that. I generally agree. I like the transparency. I think it holds everybody accountable and it also, you can't hide behind it or say something happened that didn't happen or misreport. You're not relying on anybody's interpretation of what they saw. You can watch it yourself if you want to. And I talked to Doug Weinstein, who's one of the lawyers on the YSL case, and he said he loves it and he used it as a tool. He would be reading the chat in the middle of trial and it would help him with cross-examination to hear what chats are asking about and thinking about and how they're viewing witnesses, which I think is interesting and kind of cool, but also it shows and sheds a light that the bar rules in each individual state is probably behind the technology, and they're going to have to find ways to deal with that. What are we going to allow? What are we not going to allow? Not just cameras, but what can the lawyers do actively during trial? What can witnesses do? What can cops do, investigators, whatever it may be, anybody involved? Are they allowed to just watch a stream, right? If it's just what's on, like what's in court, what's the difference between sitting in trial and just watching the stream? Can they have it with commentary? What kind of commentary? What's appropriate? What's not? So there are all these different aspects and things that are not regulated at this point. There are not a lot of rules that control much of this, which rules make things better, but they also make things worse sometimes, right? And we've learned that as a society and as we grow. But I think generally, I would welcome it. I think it's something that's good for society, especially because the people in your chat, the people in my chat, you, me, this is our society. This is our life. This is our judicial system, criminal and civil. It could very easily, if it hasn't already in our lives, affect us or our loved ones or people we just know. We could be jurors. And I think people learning and understanding what it's like and not being as scared of the process, understanding what their rights are, not get, you know, railroaded by the government, whether it's law enforcement, whether it's state attorney's office, knowing what's appropriate, what's not appropriate, seeing how things are done in different jurisdictions, maybe choosing where you live based on how their judicial system works, because there's been some that have been absolutely horrible throughout the process and everybody kind of agrees. I wouldn't want to live in this county dealing with these judges or these prosecutors or whatever it may be. So information and knowledge is power. And I think that we should give it to the people that live in our society. Why would we try to hide that, right? And I think from a criminal defense attorney's perspective, one of the things that maybe this lawyer or some lawyers who would block it, which a lot of times prosecutors try to block it too, but I think some criminal defense attorneys notice that it's a very difficult pill to swallow that kind of what you're saying, this is an interesting case to do this on. I don't feel 100% confident because I didn't watch it, you know, the whole time through, but where you're saying there were some stretches, there were some holes, there were some things, but like, I feel confident even beyond a reasonable doubt that she committed this crime. Defense lawyers go in and they pound the table and they argue hard that that is reasonable doubt. That is prototypical. That should be a not guilty verdict. I get what you're feeling. I get what you think. I get that you're not really sure it could be anybody else, but you know, X, Y, and Z in the jury instructions say that should be not guilty. That is reasonable doubt. And I think that criminal defense attorneys with that and the presumption of innocence, society as a whole struggles with that. They don't like that. It's better for 100 guilty people to go free than one innocent person to be convicted. And that's beyond a reasonable doubt is such a high burden, and presumption of innocence is so important. And as somebody sitting there, I don't care if you've seen a video on the media of them committing a crime, they are innocent as they sit there, and trying to help people kind of understand what that means can be very difficult. And you can be looked at as a slime ball, as a jerk, as somebody who puts killers back on the street as a criminal defense attorney when you make arguments like that, because people don't understand. Defending the Constitution for the worst of us is what protects it for the best of us. And we should want it to be that way. We should want criminal defendants to be looked at like that, because then we have the, oh, I can tell just by looking at you, and I've seen you talk about other cases as well, you are not nearly as confident in this verdict as you've been in some other ones, right? I fully believe you think that she did this. And so you're okay. She's got convicted. She's going to prison for the rest of her life. But there have been other cases where I know you've been a lot more confident in the defendants being guilty. And that's how we should feel when somebody's convicted. We should be confident. We should be resolute. They should get the penalty that they deserve. And that's justice for the victims. But if it's not there, criminal defense attorneys are going to argue hard. That should be not guilty. And people are uncomfortable with that. And we take the backlash from society. And as lawyers, we understand people hate us generally, no matter what kind of lawyer you are. They think a certain way about lawyers, and that's okay. And hopefully transparency and cameras in the courtroom can help them find that there are some good lawyers too. There are some bad ones, but there are some good lawyers too. And I think that's part of what lawyers don't like about cameras in the courtroom is society being able to see what we do and having a problem with the laws in our country because they don't fully understand them. And they learn more about them, I think, throughout the process like this and watching trials on channels like yours.
I love hearing that the lawyers are, you know, use the chats in a live stream to basically peer into the mind of the jury, because that's the one thing they can't do, right? They can't say, hey, you guys with me so far? You know, if I lost you, I don't need to go over anything. I think that would obviously be a huge benefit to an attorney that, you know, be able to, you know, mid-court get a review on how they're doing.
The amount of tools that lawyers have and pay for and try to use, that first off are mostly ineffective, a lot of them, some of them are very effective, to have that tool and not use it is foolish, first off, but to have that tool and being able to see what you can learn and start to gather data, like, is the law and crime chat usually, you know, in line with the jury, or is the court TV chat more, or maybe, you know, Fox or MSNBC or CNN or whatever it may be, you know, whoever's following trials, talking about trials, starting to compile data, which we are doing, and really trying to follow what different chats think about different trials and who's kind of in tune with the jury. To me, that's incredibly important. And it's not cheating, right? You're just understanding that jurors are either, because lawyers think about this stuff, right? We have these conversations. Is this too confusing? Like, I'll ask my wife sometimes, or, you know, my mom or people that are not lawyers. It's like, if I present it like this, do you get that? And not like you're stupid, but am I too in the weeds? Am I explaining things that are, you know, simple that you don't need me to explain? Am I wasting a full day of trial? Because that's the other thing. We never want to drag it out. We want to keep it simple, stupid, right? We want to keep it as simple as we possibly can. And so we're always trying to find ways to pare things down, make it digestible for the jury so they understand the evidence we're presenting. And that is the ultimate tool eventually for these trials that are being live streamed.
I tell you, I love it. Watching this and watching it with the community is absolutely incredible. You know, your community is very similar to mine. It's the best part of the internet. I mean, there's a lot of crap out there, and this is really just amazing. I learned so much from so many people who, you know, could stop and look at this a little bit differently, and just keeping an open mind as I listen to court and keep one eye on chat. It's an incredible experience. I love it. I don't think I could go back to watching court any other way.
So. Yeah, I mean, it is true, and like, disagreement sometimes can be educational. And I also like to help people understand, like, 6 to 12 random people, they're not all going to have the same ideologies. They're not all going to have the same background. They're not all going to have the same political views, religious views, socioeconomic background, upbringing. It's a group that's smushed together, and they're just the ones that didn't get cut, basically, right? And so they're in there, and they've got to all make a decision, and they have to make the same exact decision. And that's how it should be.
It's amazing that it works. I love the system. Absolutely. I've got so much respect for it. Obviously, you know, I want as much access as I can. And I, at the same time, I know that the system has to be protected. And it's fun to work with courts and, you know, fill out the paperwork and get either cameraman in there or get, you know, in there in the media pool and get stuff out. I have every single trial I learn something. It seems like every trial, it seems like we're getting crazier and crazier stuff. I'm not sure if that's a commentary on society or what, but we've just had cases. I mean, we've got this case coming up in Kentucky where we've got a sheriff who shot the judge in chambers, allegedly. I think we can say allegedly, it was on video. So just some crazy cases coming up. Obviously Brian Koberger, Corey Richens, just some big trials that,
What has surprised you the most about the process? Like, just getting into this, your background before was not specifically legal related, right?
I've loved the law since I was a kid. Like, I'd ride my bike down to the city offices and go to court and just watch it when I was a teenager. But I've never studied the law. I've read the law. I study, you know, the all the laws that are proposed and things like that. But I've never done it for work. I professionally worked for the Department of Defense. All the top secret SCI, I did fun computer stuff, and then quit that to be a YouTuber. So
yeah, so you get into this, right, and you start becoming kind of intimately involved, and you're understanding the processes and becoming part of the process, basically. And like you said, like, people watching you that are involved in cases and connected to cases. What has surprised you about just streaming trials, seeing what happens, seeing behind the curtain a little bit? Also helping to pull back the curtain a little bit. What has surprised you most?
First, I was surprised at how much I thought I knew, and I didn't. You know, I had this idea of how court worked and how process worked. I've learned so much about the process of court, the admitting evidence and the formalities that a lot of times seem sometimes a little monotonous to the casual viewer, and why it's so important, and why the roles that the judge plays compared to the jury. I've loved learning about that, and just the chess match that's played out there in the courtroom has just been, I raised my respect so much for each of the players and the role they play in court. That was eye-opening. I thought it was much more like, Perry Mason type of situation. That's my court experience. So it's been really neat to see in the different states, the slight subtle differences in, but overall how the process itself is very similar just across the country. It's been amazing.
Yeah, it does show, like, you know, people that don't travel a lot or that have lived in one place their whole life, the court system in different jurisdictions shows you, like, it kind of takes on the persona of that county, and it can be very different. Like, Tallahassee courts are very different than Miami courts. It's Florida, but it's very different. The lawyers are different, you know, even though we can practice in both. If you're, you know, barred in Florida, it's like, you know, things are going to be different depending on where you go. And even more so when you go to different parts of the country. So that's an interesting point that you bring up. And
from one judge to another. I mean, they've got their own, you know, this judge likes to pick his jury foreman, you know, like Judge Newman did in the Murdaugh trial. I didn't know that was a thing. just seeing it play out. It's always neat. There's always something a little bit different that just makes you stop and think. And I love the process. I have so much respect. I could never do it for work. I don't know how you do it. It's the stress level would be through the roof. Holding someone else's fate in my hands, just that's a huge burden.
It's incredibly stressful and incredibly frustrating at times. Like, especially the lack of repercussions or just the lack of care for a lot of people that hold a lot of power and have the ability and the means, and they do ruin or seriously negatively affect people's lives and then don't really seem to care, don't treat people as people anymore, you know, and it can be really frustrating. The stress levels, yeah, are obvious. But yeah, it's fun and it's really rewarding, but you know, it is hard. I mean, it there's no like sugarcoating it. I think there are ways to manage it. And I think it's really important to think about that before you get into it, or you can dive so deep and then you're in it and you can never get out of it. I've seen that happen with a lot of lawyers as well. So I think perspective is important and balance is important.
I can't tell you how often I hear, oh, I'm a little OCD. I like things neat. That's not OCD. I'm Howie Mandel, and I know this because I have OCD. Actual OCD causes relentless unwanted thoughts. What if I did something terrible and forgot? What if I'm a bad person? Why am I thinking this terrible thing? It makes you question absolutely everything, and you'll do anything to feel better. OCD is debilitating, but it's also highly treatable with the right kind of therapy. Regular talk therapy doesn't cut it. OCD needs specialized therapy. That's why I want to tell you about NoCD. NoCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for OCD. Their licensed therapists provide specialized therapy virtually, and it's covered by insurance for over 155 million Americans. If you think you might be struggling with OCD, visit NoCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call and learn more. That's NoCD.com.
Tired of scrolling through endless sitter profiles on other sites only to get ghosted? For over 20 years, Sitter City has been the go-to resource for parents who want a more personalized, reliable way to find trustworthy sitters and nannies. While other sites flood you with options, Sitter City focuses on bringing you high-quality matches that are the right fit for your family every time. With SitterCity.com, you can find full-time, part-time, or occasional care that meets your specific needs. Every caregiver is ID verified, and profiles include real parent reviews, background checks, and specialized experience, so you can spend less time searching and more time doing what matters most, spending time with your family. And did you know that many employers include Sitter City as part of their benefits package? In a few clicks, find out if you can get Sitter City free. Getting started has never been easier. Take the guesswork out of finding care so you can breathe easier knowing your kids are in good hands. Visit SitterCity.com today to get the care you need.
What has been your favorite, like, what do we think have been the best and worst part about streaming trials, understanding the process, talking to people about it, just generally on the internet? I'm sure you go wider than just your chat because, you know, I agree. My chat's the easiest one to deal with and the easiest ones to talk to. Then sometimes when you go to the wider audience, it gets a little wilder.
This is a little weird, but a little off, but the chat has been the best part. Not the chat, but the community.
Yeah.
Because I've made connections with very, very diverse people, you know, lawyers, with, you know, public defenders, with victim advocates, and heard so many personal stories that I realized I was seeing the world like this, right?
Yeah.
You know, and I thought I had the broad panoramic vision. It's really given me a reason to stop. And I'm a different person now because I watch trials, because I it's caused me to look at things and say, you know, I need to look at something from a different perspective, because I now know that how little I can see. And, you know, these other perspectives, they enlighten me. They're amazing. Just people are good. I've learned that a lot of people deserve second chances, and, you know, people make mistakes. And, you know, I think of one thing, I think our justice system throws people away too easily. And so anyway, it's been inspiring. I love to see wins. I love to, you know, as much as I hate a pro se defendant, because it's an awful thing to do to yourself, I love to see one win. And especially when it seems like the system was just sort of, you know, trying to shove him in the hole. And I don't know. I've loved the whole process.
Yeah. That's cool. Well, Scott, I appreciate it, man. This was fun. I mean, it's really, you have kind of a nice perspective to you, and just, you're easy to listen to, easy to talk to. I also like that, you know, we cover very difficult and sometimes sad and stressful and miserable and brutal stories and cases. And so I think it's important to have your perspective and the way you look at it. I think that's probably helpful for your chat as well. But I really appreciate you taking the time to come hang with me for an hour and talk about this case. I'm going to put all of your links and everything in the description, but why don't you tell everybody where they can find you, what specifically you like to do. I don't know if you have a schedule of when you post or things like that, but let the people know.
Well, we pretty much are live 5 days a week, 8 hours a day, following courts around the country, some court hopping. And you know, we send equipment down to different places. We had equipment down at Sarah Boone. I know some, they ran into you down there. That was awesome. But we love the court system in the United States, and we like to follow court cases around the country and bring that to you with, I've got, well, I'm not sure if I can show you here. I've got like my setup's a little bit elaborate, but.
Now that makes sense with your background now. If I knew how to show you mine, which I don't, it's one camera and my computer and my keyboard here.
It looks phenomenal. It does so great. I do a lot with audio. So we try to take out background noise. You know, I can take out, you know, the hum of an air conditioner, or take off, you know, paper rustling and things like that. So we try to make it this experience of watching court a little better here. And we do it in a friendly, respectful environment where, you know, differing opinions are accepted. So Recovery Addict on YouTube. And I think on all the social media, some variant of that as well. So.
Awesome, man. Awesome. Well, I appreciate it. Until next time, folks, we're out of here. Thanks for watching another episode of The Lawyer You Know. If you enjoyed the episode, please hit the thumbs up and share with your friends who may be interested here on YouTube. And don't forget to subscribe. You can also follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and TikTok. And don't forget to check out The Lawyer You Know podcast, with new seasons dropping every quarter. If you have a case you want to talk to us about, if it's a personal injury case, wrongful death, catastrophic injury, car accident, or slip and fall case, please email us at lawyeryouknow@gmail.com. And of course, all these links I just mentioned are included in the description below on this episode and every episode. So until next time, this is Peter Tragos, The Lawyer You Know.